the one thing I have learnt over the last 50 years is that one must not give up. You know, that's the worst possible thing, is to give up because things seem bad. We have to fight back with every means possible and carry on and help those who are fighting back and speak on behalf of those who can't. Thank you very much.
That's Tariq Ali, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Tariq Ali on Connections, 1968 and 2018. 1968 is often described as historic, a tumultuous year that changed the United States and the world. Recall the assassinations of Dr. King and Robert Kennedy, resistance to the wars in Indochina, the student strikes, the Tet Offensive, the ghetto uprisings, and the election of Richard Nixon. In France, the rebellion against the status quo was marked by the famous slogan, "Be realistic, demand the impossible." That was then. Today, the power structure pursues its agenda as it always has, enhancing its global hegemony and wealth accumulation. The whole history of the last five decades demonstrates that no section of the ruling class is opposed to the imposition of U.S. global domination. There are merely tactical differences. Things are changing. China is on the rise. The U.S. remains preeminent militarily, but its economic position is in decline. Our guest today is Tariq Ali. He's an internationally renowned writer and activist based in London, where he is an editor of New Left Review. He's the author of many books, including The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Pirates of the Caribbean, and The Extreme Center. He spoke at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And now, Tariq Ali.
The two important points that need to be made when we're discussing 1968 today. The first is that we are living now in very different times. And the echoes of 1968, which the French, young French students perceive, are that, echoes. Echoes of an important struggle that was waged in very different times. Times of hope, times when people not simply believed but thought they could defeat power, and a time when the big inspiration that began what we know as the 60s was the heroic decision of the Vietnamese people and their organizations not to give up. They had fought the Japanese, they had fought the French, and now the Americans were trying to colonize them, and they were determined not to give up. And they didn't. And it was their historical and epic struggle against the world's mightiest, largest, most powerful nation in the world that inspired a whole generation, not just in the United States, which it did, but all over the world, in Europe, in Africa, in South America, continent after continent. People, this struggle, shown every night on national television, was etched in the memory and the minds of those young people who were watching. So that when the French general strike erupted in May 68, the largest strike in the history of capitalism, with 10 million workers on strike or occupying their factories and demanding radical change, the students renamed the historic streets of Paris during this occupation, and one of the streets renamed in the Latin Quarter was called the Street of Heroic Vietnam. And we tend, those of us from the generations that followed, to forget the role that war played. And added to that role, I have to add, because this is also increasingly forgotten, is the birth of the anti-war movement in the United States of America, its growth, its development, its challenge to the holders of power in the White House, in the State Department, in the Pentagon, and at a later stage, once this movement had begun, the emergence of the GIs against the war, uniformed soldiers of the empire, many retired, many ill, many disabled, with their purple hearts and an array of medals across their chests, marching outside the Pentagon in 72 and declaring that they wanted the Vietnamese to win. Now, that was an act of internationalism that has that has no equivalent in the in imperial history. And so we should not forget those valiant soldiers who decided that truth was more important than carrying out orders. And that, too, had an enormous impact on the world. So 68 taught the world internationalism. It was a global struggle and a global strike against war that we've ever seen, the most important that we'd ever seen. And it was from Vietnam and what was being done to Vietnam that it occurred to us that we had to try and do the same in different ways and destroy capitalism. That was the overwhelming desire on part of people. Not just to demand reforms, but to say the system has got to go. And if you look at the slogans that were chanted in those times, that is what they were. Optimistic beyond belief, exaggerated, angry, but demanding a new system, a new social system. I say that because the world today is very different. If those were periods, if the 20th century was an epoch of revolutions, and there had been many since 1917, the 1917 followed by upheavals and strikes in Hungary, in Germany, the crushing of the German Revolution by the most extreme wing of the German militarists, which later paved the way for the Third Reich. Had the German Revolution won, there would have been no Third Reich, and there would have been no atrocities on that particular scale, including the Judeocide. But those who backed the German rulers to win also gave us Hitler. Then moving out of Europe, we saw an astonishing 20-year struggle between the radical anti-capitalists in the Chinese Communist Party against nationalists led by the Kuomintang. And this revolution finally succeeded in 1949. Its anniversary will be marked next year, in 2019. And together, the Russian and the Chinese revolutions, different though they were, took two of the largest countries of the world outside the capitalist world market. Now, whatever mistakes, whatever atrocities were committed in these countries by their rulers, we know. But leaving them aside for the moment, it was a huge triumph against capital, global capital. And they knew it. And the United States, Woodrow Wilson, much proclaimed as a peacemaker, had set up a committee at the highest levels of the state whose aim was to topple the Bolsheviks from April 1917 onwards. This committee was set up. And this committee included two men who were to play a huge role in the Cold War to come, the Dulles brothers. One became head of the intelligence networks, and the other later became a Secretary of State. And the stage was set to defeat what was happening, and that they didn't give up till the Soviet system imploded, largely through the fault of its own rulers, it has to be said. And it's worth bearing in mind that it did not require any armed intervention to defeat the Soviet Union. It happened from within. It happened because there were people who from 1956 onwards had wanted change, had wanted reform. And one of the tragedies of 1968, but also a heroic struggle, was the struggle waged by the reform communists of Czechoslovakia, whose leader, Alexander Dubček, general secretary of the party, decided on a reform program in April 1968. And the aim of the program was to democratize Czechoslovakia. And it was called, even by a hostile Western media, Dubček's phrase resounded, "What we want is socialism with a human face." And in that period, from April to August 1968, I would say that Czechoslovakia was probably the freest country in the world in relation to its media and in relation to what could be published and in relation to the debates that were taking place, defining socialism. What does socialism consist of? Does socialism simply meaning nationalizing anything that moves? No, this has been a failure, they said. It doesn't mean that. It means implementing democratic values so that the name of socialism and communism, tarred for so long, can begin to be cleansed of all the rubbish which may have been necessary, it may not have been. And this experiment began to seep into the rest of Eastern Europe. And it was when Czech printing workers who decided that their magazines could be infiltrated into the Soviet Union, and they started with the Ukraine, but they were spreading, that the Politburo of the Soviet Union decided to intervene and end the Czech experiment. And that was, they didn't know it then, but that was actually the end of the Soviet Union itself. Why? Because they lost their own intelligentsia. The intelligentsia in Russia has played a huge part over the last two centuries, till now, in the forefront of struggle against tyranny. And in the case of Russia itself, many didn't support the Bolsheviks, some did, but all hoped that reforms would come. And Khrushchev's speech in 1956 denouncing the crimes of Stalin created this hope yet again. But when Brezhnev invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968, and crushed the movement. It's very interesting what happened. Again, forgotten. The first wave of Soviet soldiers, Red Army soldiers who went in, were greeted with open arms by the Czechs, and they said, "Why are you here?" And the Russians replied, "Because we are told you are counter-revolution." They said, "We are counter-revolutionaries. We are carrying the red flag. We are carrying portraits of Marx and Lenin. We are counter-revolutionaries. Or are you?" And the soldiers refused to open fire. And the entire first wave had to be sent back and more pliable soldiers found in order to continue the disgraceful and appalling invasion of that country. And you know something? A writer, a conservative writer, like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, later awarded the Nobel Prize, later wrote, he was in answering a questioner who said, "When did the Soviet Union die for you, Mr. Solzhenitsyn?" And Solzhenitsyn said, "It died for me on the 21st of August 1968 when our troops went and crushed socialism with a human face in Czechoslovakia, because then I realized that if they were doing this to Czechoslovakia, we would never get reforms from below. And I gave up." And that applied to lots of other people as well. And that was a huge defeat for the left. And the triumphs, of course, were the enormous victories of the Vietnamese, helped by the anti-war movement in the United States. And the whole of Western Europe was up in arms to see what could be done to help the Vietnamese, to accelerate the struggle at home, etc., etc. And then, leaving aside Europe and America, you had a situation in Mexico where there were the Summer Olympics, The famous image we now remember is of two African-American athletes raising the Black Power salute, as it's called, but it's the old red salute of the Communist International. Like this, in solidarity with people fighting everywhere, because they had been told the minute they arrived in Mexico that there'd been a massacre the week before the Olympics, in which over 300 Mexican students had been massacred, killed, destroyed in a big square. And these were the conditions in which these wretched Olympics took place. So it makes me smile when I hear of countries being boycotted over Olympics, winter and summer ones, for crimes which don't even measure up to one quarter of what was done in Mexico at that time. And the big triumph, of course, of the movements came in Pakistan. Now, I was speaking in France 3 or 4 weeks ago on 68, and I said to them, just from the audience, I said, how many of you, and there are about 400 or 500 people there, how many of you remember anything happening in a country like Pakistan? I said, did you hear what happened in Pakistan in 68? And about 4 people raised their hands whose hair was as white as mine. The young didn't know. So I told them what happened, is that in November 1968, a student movement developed in Pakistan, which spread rapidly over the next 4 weeks to the whole country. They were shot, they were tear gassed, and they carried on. And as they carried on, more and more people from different social layers came and joined them. Virtually every social layer, junior civil servants, young army officers said they were not going to open fire on these demonstrations anymore. That was the beginning of the end for the military dictatorship. Workers, sections of the peasantry, prostitutes came out, openly admitting who they were and saying, we are with you. Medical students, doctors, the hospitals were empty. It was a huge social explosion. We outmaneuvered them on every single level. It was only later, when the fruits of the movement had been squandered by many of its leaders, when Pakistan had split up, when no alternative was left, that some people began to drift off to religion as an alternative. And it is also true that a number of radical leaders from Lahore and Karachi were so alienated from what had happened after our victory that they joined the Jamaat-e-Islami, became some of its leaders of its youth. Exactly the same process in Egypt, exactly the same process in Algeria. Feeling desperate, feeling we hadn't achieved what had been promised by Nasser in Egypt, by the movement in Pakistan, by the liberation struggle in Algeria. Not in huge numbers, but quite key people moved. And for them, it was a way of doing politics differently. And they did it. But it wasn't preordained that it would be like this. So 68 was a mixed bag. But the important thing is that it took place in a context, as I said earlier, in which victories seemed possible. That's the big difference with today. I mean, I don't want to be too extreme on this, but I would say that the period that opened up after the big triumph of capital, the complete collapse of the Soviet Union and that whole world, despite all its weaknesses, was seen by multi-million masses in different continents as the end, not just by intellectuals. They said if they couldn't succeed, what's going to happen to us? And the, of course, the triumphalism and euphoria exhibited by this country and its leaders, we've won, it's our victory, that is it, indicated that what was taking place, in fact, was a counter-revolution. And in many of these Eastern European countries, the people who ultimately came to power, and many of whom are in power today, are people who were aligned in one shape or another with the Third Reich during the Second World War. The Hungarians, Houthiites, the Croatians, its right-wing politicians, fought against the resistance movement led by Tito, and these groups have re-emerged and are re-emerging, as they are in parts of Western Europe, by the way. I mean, if you look at Italy, many say that there are some cities where it's impossible to criticize Mussolini because he's very popular, because it's a right-wing city. In Germany, too, there are ominous signs of a shift to the right. So we live in a period where the counter-revolution has triumphed. And what does that mean? That means that they're going to kill anyone or anything that tries to seriously challenge the system as a whole. That's what it means. And they do it already in South America. So what has now become possible is what many of us used to mock in the 60s and 70s, which is some decent form of social democracy that ends austerity, that ends the neoliberal system, that reintroduces a large social safety net for a majority of the population, that puts back into motion those ideas which neoliberalism destroyed. It's interesting that neoliberalism, in this case like the Third Reich, developed its own vocabulary and its own language and its own ways of speaking. Like everything regressive that was done, like massive privatizations, like public-private deals which basically put the hospitals, mortgaged the hospitals to moneylenders for a long, long time to come. All these were presented as reforms. And those who said, like I did, constantly, that they are not reforms, they are regressions, were called dinosaurs. So fine, I said, you can call us dinosaurs, but you know, it's pointless behaving there. Try and answer our arguments. Why are you doing this? It's not going to work. That was our principal argument. It is not going to work, and it is going to concentrate wealth at the very top and leave the rest, if not to starve, in poor conditions. And that is what's happened in country after country. And so after the 2008 Wall Street crash, we saw a turn. People, if not challenging in the system, challenging this particular variant of the system. And new movements erupted, social movements, in a number of European countries, and to a certain extent in the United States, and most dramatically in South America, where they said we are going to use the wealth we have or the wealth we create to benefit the poor. And in South America, they began to do it. And an enormous campaign began against the South Americans. I mean, if you look at what the press was writing about Venezuela soon after Chavez's victories, it was exactly the same. You could read the same text in the New York Times, slightly different in the London Guardian, in El País in Spain, etc. Why they wasted so much money sending so many different journalists when one would have sufficed, I don't know. But that crash was the beginning of a huge question mark. This system which they told us, and what they called globalization, which was going to transform our lives, decrease disparities, offer everyone a chance, trickle-down economics. All this, they said, didn't happen. Instead, we've nearly seen the system go under. And when the system, the financial capitalist system, was close to collapse, what did they do? They did everything that we were told was forbidden to the left, to social democrats. Why should the state help you, they used to say. Everything has to be self-sufficient. The state can't help you. When these scoundrels basically, through their policies, crashed, what did they do? They went on their knees and said, "Dear state, please help us." And the state spent trillions of dollars in bailing them out. It would have been much, much better if they hadn't bailed all of them out, if they'd let some of these banks go under, simply protecting the small account holders in these outfits, not those who were using this for speculation. Might have cleansed the system somewhat, but no. They carried on as before. And carrying on as before meant that it was a return to the status quo. It's what I call described it as a result of this, and even prior to it, an extreme center had emerged at the center of European politics. By the extreme center, I mean the center-left and center-right parties which alternate in government, and maybe it's different on certain cultural questions, but on the central issues of the day, carry out the same policies. It's the same here. In fact, they learnt it from the United States, which is very hegemonic now in Europe, not just politically, in politics, but in culture. And just as a footnote here, the most amazing films and documentaries that were produced in Italy, France, Germany, the Scandinavian countries, from the 50s to the early 80s, have collapsed, gone. What every single American director, French or German director, not every single, there are a few good people, but by and large they want to mimic Hollywood. So Hollywood specializes in crime movies. We'll do our version of crime movies. The pattern is now exactly the same, because some do them better than others. The New York Times bestseller list is immediately translated into these languages, and publishers, eyes shut in some cases, decide what to publish on the basis of what is selling well in the United States, which is often a lot of tripe. So this is the globalization that has actually strengthened U.S. hegemony in Europe. And it is this which I call the extreme center, globally and in these countries, where you can elect whoever you like. Not all that much changes. And let me be a bit provocative. I mean, Trump is, you know, a desperate publicity seeker who says the most appalling things to be at the center of attention globally and in this country. The things he promised, which won him some support, were that he would clear the swamp of Wall Street, clean out the mess, that he would stop these wasteful wars going on, etc. What's changed? The swamp runs through the White House. Trump is busy fighting wars, threatening new ones, appointing people whose sanity really should be questioned. I'm referring here to John Bolton. This is a guy who's threatening war against North Korea, Iran, who's got an appalling record in South America, and he's been plucked out of nowhere and put in charge on some things again. But in general, the basic trend of U.S. economic policy, and military policy, imperial policy, till now, has not changed that much.
You're listening to Tariq Ali on Connections, 1968 and 2018. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
So a lot of what was done in the past is still being continued. Now, obviously, on cultural and social policies, on matters such as abortion, gay rights, etc., not to talk about the rights of the African-American community, I mean, the thing which Trump has done openly and publicly is what was never done in this fashion in public before. Is basically encourage white supremacist attitudes in the country again. I'm saying it's fine, you can say that. Not a huge problem without denouncing them. Now, if you go back and read the Nixon, or listen to the Nixon tapes, if you can't sleep one night and want something to do, and avoid Netflix, but just binge watch the Nixon tapes. And you will see Nixon coming up with all sorts of racist and anti-Semitic arguments. It's quite shocking, no different from Trump. Trump hasn't gone down the anti-Semitic route. But there is a surprising continuity in U.S. politics. And this is now the method being followed in Europe as well. And that is, of course, deeply worrying. It's not always the case that this is happening. I mean, we had a politician in the United States, Bernie Sanders, who excited young people and older people too, and promised social democratic reforms if he were to win. And he might have won. We don't know. We'll never know now, against Trump. And he was maligned out of existence virtually. But he has left behind a legacy of large numbers of young people who want radical change. And that's his. That'll be, if he's remembered in the future, it will be for that. That he offered some hope to people. And in Britain, we have Jeremy Corbyn, who's gone one step beyond Trump, beyond Sanders, and won over the leadership of the Labour Party, and is now slowly trying to transform this party into an instrument for serious social democratic reforms. He's also very radical on foreign policy. So he came within a whisker of winning, and he might well win the next elections. It won't be easy, because the knives are out for him, but he is going to try. So it's not, you know, one cannot say that today's world is hopeless in that sense. People haven't given up the struggle, as we see in this country, as we see in other parts of the world, but their aims are not what they used to be in the 60s, and quite honestly, that's fine, as far as I'm concerned. I would be much, much unhappier if there were no struggles at all, and tiny groups of people belonging to tiny sects would sit and say something that is totally pure, in which, you know, we could all applaud. That's not politics. That's effectively denying realities. And so when I read that the DSA, an organization which was more or less moribund, defunct, has revived and has 30,000 members, I am pleased, because it's quite large. Not that large for the states, and not large at all compared to the 500,000 new members that joined the British Labour Party after Corbyn's victory. 500,000, making Labour the largest political party in Europe. But it's still not unimportant. So this is going to be a lengthy, slow, sometimes quicker process. But the struggle will continue. New spaces will open up. And the one thing I have learnt over the last 50 years is that one must not give up. You know, that's the worst possible thing, is to give up because things seem bad. To fight back. One has to fight back with every means possible for those who, for a variety of reasons, cannot fight back. They cannot fight back because they're refugees and they might be killed, or they might be dumped in the Mediterranean Sea, or they might be thrown out of windows as accidents. So in this situation, we have to fight back and carry on and help those who are fighting back and speak on behalf of those who can't. Thank you very much.
You talked about how 1968...
Yeah, okay. The question was, what lessons can we learn from some of the setbacks of 68? Well, you know, if the whole history of the last two centuries in the world, as far as our side is concerned, has been a history of setbacks. Think about it. All the times we have lost, and yet people have arisen again to try and change things. I have to be honest with you. it's very difficult to say what lesson we can learn from defeats, because these defeats occur in different times, in different circumstances, in different contexts. All we need to have a world or countries or small states or large states who learn to trust their people, work with them, consult them on the best possible basis of democracy to see what can be done, what is possible. Will we be able to do that? I don't know. There are no certainties left in this world any longer. And it's stupid constantly to think in the terms of the first half of the 20th century, in terms of what is the revolutionary subject. Because the deindustrializations that have taken place under neoliberalism, whether intended or not, their consequences have been virtually to destroy all the big industrial unions, apart from the car workers and the railway workers. Most of the big industrial unions have been wrecked. So what shape is an upheaval going to take? How is it going to move forward? Is it going to be a struggle via the nationalities, as Scotland and Catalonia have shown in Europe for some time? We do not know. But anything that is positive and progressive and moves forward should be supported. It would be crazy for groups, small groups in particular, but big groups too, to put their own narrow interests above those of the movement as a whole. I mean, I think, just to give you, and you know, we think modestly now, but just to give you an example, I think if a political organization or movement or whatever you call it emerged in the United States from the Sanders mobilizations and had a membership of 100,000, 150,000 people, that would be a huge step forward for the American left and progressive people in this country. A huge step forward. So that's how we have to think. There are no clear-cut answers. You know, we do this, we do that, we quote Lenin, we quote Marx. It's foolish to carry on that way. We must learn from all these giants of the past. But we live in a very different world in some ways.
So I'm entering that very different world as a recently enfranchised citizen, part of a citizen body that seems to be reacting negatively to the progress that you spoke of in the previous century. What action would you suggest for a young person such as myself moving forward?
It's a strange business, the states, because its constitution laws are irregular and often discourage people from participating in elections. I mean, if you study them closely, that is what emerges. But, I mean, my advice today to someone like you who wants to think, experiment, etc., is to see what the DSA has to offer, really. I mean, I would just do it. If you don't like it, quit. But at least go in there to see what is being offered, what the level of debates are, and what could be done. I mean, I'm in one of those who does believe that electoral interventions are necessary. I think Seattle is a good model for what is possible sometimes. And I think to write off all this is wrong. I would love it if there were, you know, three or four, let's be modest, socialist senators and 10 or 15 congresspersons who are on the left. At least you have something in there. Even one person can do quite a lot. And we shall see if this is going to be possible in the United States or whether electoral representation is going to be confined to those who belong to the big parties and those who just need money and cannot function without money. So that would be my advice here in the present circumstances, apart, of course, from helping the movements who are struggling for on single issues, campaigns of their own, Black Lives Matter, the school students' campaign against the NRA, etc. But I would, you know, suggest there's no harm in giving the DSA a go.
So do you mind if I ask a follow-up question?
No, not at all.
As far as electoral intervention is concerned, especially in the United States, do you think it's to the advantage of somebody who lives in a state like Wisconsin to vote for third-party candidates? Is that a possibility at the state level, at the national level, or even as far as the presidency is concerned?
It depends. It depends on what the third party is, what it's offering, but it's better than nothing. I know lots of people abstained in the last presidential elections. Quite a few Democrats didn't go out and vote because they didn't like their own candidate. I mean, currently, liberals are sort of saying they only lost because of Vladimir Putin and not looking at the mirror. And that, I think, is unfortunate because it miseducates people. But I think these things you have to decide, that these are tactics which have to be determined locally. And coming from London, I can't give you sort of concrete advice on that, but it's that sort of thing that has to be considered. I mean, the other thing worth bearing in mind is lots of people are saying, probably correctly, that we should have a one-person, one-vote electoral system for the presidency, which instinctively one thinks is correct. But there is another side to it, that were that to happen effectively, the West Coast and the East Coast would decide. Quite a lot of states in between would not matter at all and would, in that sense, not be visited by candidates or politicians, which might be a good thing you could then develop. But that's all, really.
Sir, could you reflect on social media, such as tweets and posts on Facebook and what they are doing to politics? What would 1968 have been like if people had been tweeting, if Nixon had been tweeting?
If we'd had the social networks in 68, we'd have had a lot more fun. That I can promise you. Because it was a nightmare meeting up with people you wanted to hang out with or go out with. You know, you couldn't even leave messages on the phone in those days. They had to be handwritten and delivered carefully, etc., etc. So it would have transformed that. And I do think about this quite often, that in terms of mobilizing for demonstrations, we would have probably doubled or trebled the size of our demonstrations if we'd had those networks, without any doubt at all. I mean, we got 100,000 people against the Vietnam War in October 68, and we thought this was great, and everyone thought, God, 100,000 people. But in the same city, we mobilized 1 million people against the war in Iraq. And the big, big change was the social networks. People mobilized in every possible way. We were amazed when 1 million people turned out. That's the difference. I would be the first person to be behind the barricades if there was any chance of a revolution anywhere. But all I notice is that when movements arise, social movements, which create political movements, the most they can do is some form of social democracy. They haven't got the confidence, or they feel it's impossible to make a revolution like the Cubans did, or the Chinese did, or the Russians did, or the Vietnamese did. They feel they can't do it. And the reason they feel that is because they know that the system is strong and they will be probably could not get much popular support. You can't make those revolutions without popular support. That's the reason. It's not that I've become a social democrat. I'm just saying what is happening and why it is happening and why being sectarian to these sort of new social democratic style sui generis movements is foolish, because you have nothing else to offer them except saying, let's go for it. But you know, if you and I go for it, nothing much is going to change. I wish it was the opposite, but it's just a fact at the moment. And in fact, getting left social democratic's government increased the space massively to discuss many, many other possibilities, including moving forward. That you shouldn't give up on. I mean, till 2008, people had given up on anything. Nothing was possible, more or less. That situation is now changed with what we are seeing both in Europe and North America, and that's what should be borne in mind.
You were celebrating protests by young people and students here, but also supporting Chavez and Maduro, who have been repressing students and others protesting.
The movement which brought Chavez to power was a historic movement, which came to power because it struggled against neoliberalism atrocities. Thousands of people died in the Caracazo when workers and others went out on the streets to protest what? The cancellation of government subsidies on food and transport under the instructions of the International Monetary Fund. That is what triggered off that thing, and that was done by the oligarchic parties. So that's the first answer, that is what created the whole Bolivarian movement by giving it victories. Chavez won victory after victory in that country. The second thing is this. During the Chavez period, the big attempts that were made to topple him were made by who? Right-wing political parties backed by the U.S. embassy and backed by the old university system, which was largely limited to the kids of middle and upper middle class people. Very noticeable thing about Venezuela, because I've been there several times, was both the class divide and the color divide. And the racial divide was very strong. Chavez was constantly being attacked as a monkey. They had a celebration once with the opposition parties in the U.S. embassy where actual monkeys were brought in and labeled Chavistas. So it wasn't just any old people who were in the movement against him. It was people who couldn't tolerate the fact that power had been taken away from them for some time. That's why I supported Chavez, and I'm very, very proud of having done so.
The current regime?
By Maduro. Yeah, it's extreme. I mean, I don't support that, obviously. But nor do I support the participation of some students and many opposition groups in the march on the hospital and setting alight a gynecological unit of that hospital on fire because it was a hospital set up by the government. So you have to bear in mind what is going on in Venezuela. It's not that they are the neutrals anymore. It's a deeply divided country. And both sides carry out activities which are unsupportable.
Yeah, I wanted to change the discussion to the Middle East and get your take on what's going on in Israel.
Well, look, I'll have to be very brief because, you know, as you know, this is a huge question. But effectively, the Israeli government since the Oslo Accords, have not given an inch. This is now accepted. And the PLO made, in my opinion, as the late Edward Said argued, a huge mistake in capitulating at the time of Oslo. And we are paying the price that the Israeli governments have moved regularly to the right. The fact that Netanyahu can be even regarded as a moderate or rational leader beggars the imagination. Many people in Israel don't see him like that, leave alone Palestine and the other parts of the Arab world. It's only in the United States where the media and the entire political system is so geared to Israel that they gave him, that Israel has been given a bill, a blank check by the Senate and the Congress to do whatever it wants to supposedly defend itself. Defend itself against whom? No Arab country threatens it. It's got nuclear weapons, for God's sake. And we know, as the North Koreans have shown, that the one effect nuclear weapons have is it prevents anyone from attacking you. I think that is important to remember. Who is going to attack Israel knowing full well it has nuclear weapons? Which country wants to be wiped out? The Israelis are quite capable of using them, of any country in the world today. So the question boils down to, are the Israelis going to offer any concessions to the Palestinians, serious concessions, that would enable the Palestinians to live in dignity? The Palestinians would even be prepared not to have an army, just a police force. The answer is no. They want to create Bantustans. That's the situation. It's a horrific situation. And in Europe, by the way, every time an opinion poll is taken, almost every time over the last 10 years, when citizens are asked, which is the country you regard as the biggest danger to world peace, the reply comes, Israel. In the United States, by and large, people don't even know what's going on in Israel. Recently, over the last 12 to 15 months, the New York Times has taken to publishing the odd op-ed piece. Not too regularly, but they do publish some stuff. So what it will change the situation here, I think, is a new generation of young Jewish people who see themselves basically as Americans and not tied to the Israelis. Opinion polls are stressing that this is the case, that many opinion polls have said that young people of Jewish origin are saying they don't feel any loyalty to Israel, they don't want to be identified with it, and this is creating some problems amongst the elders of AIPAC and others, saying how the hell are we going to reverse this, because it's in the medium term even, it's a bit of a disaster. So that is effectively what's going on. The notion that there's an equivalence between the Israelis and the Palestinians, come off it. What is the equivalence between a colonial power and the colony? There's no difference. And it does rule Palestine like a colony. Ask people, just go and live there and ask people. Some of the best Israelis are leaving the country. They can't bear it anymore. But everyone knows that except people in the United States who want to keep their eyes shut. That's what's going on. Who want to ban the BDS movement, who don't even want to have this subject discussed. Better not to know. Better to keep our eyes shut. Otherwise, we might have to take awkward decisions.
I'm concerned about the division of people who are left of center. So just to put in categories like the mainstream Democrats who supported Clinton versus the progressives who supported Bernie Sanders. So I was just wondering if you had anything to say about that.
Well, I've said it throughout my speech that I think what would be a great thing is to have a progressive political party in the United States well to the left of the Democrats in which everyone can participate, without which agrees, has a minimum program of 6 or 7 points, finds agreement on them, which must include the United States and as an imperial power. I notice movements springing up on everything under the sun, but not a single anti-imperialist movement yet. Apart from the demonstrations against the Iraq War, which were very big in this country as well, but after people failed, they thought they might actually stop it, which was foolish, but they thought they would, which, you know, they tried to do. People went back and never came out again. And the fact that between 1 million and 1.5 million Iraqis have died in the occupation, and that NATO's bombing, 6 months of bombing, killed at least 30,000 Libyans. And these figures are written off. They don't matter. People don't think about them. Oh, that's happening out there. They're Arabs, you know. They misbehave. We have to go and sort them out. This is the attitude, obviously not amongst progressive people, but in general. And it's not a good thing. So what this country is, an empire, weakened but not far from dead, is doing in other parts of the world, you have to take this on board. It's not isolated from what they do at home. And this is the big lesson from the 60s, which the anti-war movement here and all those brave and courageous soldiers who'd fought in Vietnam and came out against the war have taught us. And we at least owe it to them not to forget.
Thank you very much.
You were just listening to Tariq Ali on Connections, 1968 and 2018. He spoke in Madison, Wisconsin. Tariq Ali is an internationally renowned writer and activist based in London, where he's the editor of New Left Review. He's the author of many books, including The Clash of Fundamentalisms and The Extreme Center. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Jeremy Scahill, Nancy McLean, Michael Parenti, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Chris Hedges, and Nomi Prince. And we have a series of Tariq Ali programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Norm Stockwell. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.